Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Gary Mack, Greg Ross Last Post podcast. G'day, Greg. Good to see you, mate.
Yeah, good to be here, Gary, as always. Fantastic. And we've got a very special guest on today.
We have. I've conducted a couple of rather lengthy phone calls. Someone that all of Australia loves, endears. He's still busy working out there, treading the boards, playing all over Australia. His name, Norman John Rowe. Normie Rowe will be our guest for this episode and for the one that follows in the next few days. What are your earliest recollections of Norm, Greg?
A very early memory, Gary, was my twin brother and I, Craig, were in the back seat of a car. We're travelling around Melbourne with our cousins, our two female cousins, who were slightly older than Craig and I. Normie comes on the radio and they started screaming and yelling out Normie's name. So Craig and I looked at each other and said, "Who's Normie?" Of course, excuse the ignorance, but we were soon educated.
Norm is really an icon. He's a legend. He's probably one of the nicest blokes you could ever meet in the music industry. And he stood the test of time. He's been there. And as I said earlier, he's still working. Anywhere you want to go and look, he's there.
Yeah. And I went with a few friends to see him, 8 years ago now at Oakley RSL, Gary, with Gil Matthews and the mob there, the Playboys. Absolutely brilliant.
Now, Greg, for this episode, I've put you in charge of records. Remember them? You've got the turntable next to you. Can you put the needle on the edge of that record on that turntable, please?
I was thinking you were never going to ask. How brilliant. Yes, would love to do it, Gary. Here we go.
Normie Rowe was the undisputed king of pop in 1967 and 68 and had hits that charted for more than 6 months. Please welcome Normie Rowe.
G'day, Norm. Make yourself comfortable, mate. It is indeed a pleasure to welcome you to the Last Post Radio Show podcast. At last.
It's been a little while getting underway, but we've got it together now, Gary.
We certainly have, young man. Look, I want to start right away about your soulmate, the love of your life, your lovely Sam. Tell me about Sam.
Well, Samantha and I met about 7-8 years ago. And funnily enough, I don't know why our paths never crossed before, because her dad, her late dad was Dennis Gowing, Kevin Dennis Motors and Kevin Dennis New Faces and all that sort of stuff. And she's been going backwards and forwards across the business most of her life, and she knows more people in show business than I do. So how we never got together much earlier, I don't know. But it's a delightful union, I've got to say. It's the best time I've had in my life outside of being on stage.
You deserve it all, mate. You really do. It's wonderful. And is she nearby at the moment? Not that I'm asking to talk to her, but is she nearby at the moment?
Yeah, well, she's a consulting chef and a teacher of gastronomy and all things to do with food. She teaches for the Cordon Bleu School in Paris. She's got her own course that is available online. All anybody needs to do is look up Chef Sam or Samantha Gowing, and they can find all the things that she's doing. She's a really busy girl.
I'm going to tap that in straight away when you and I finish talking. Well, there's one thing that is for certain, that you won't starve, mate.
Well, I won't want for good food, I can assure you.
You've not put on a few kilos or not? I know you keep fit. I know you keep yourself out of mischief and you keep yourself fit, but it must be hard sometimes.
Look, Samantha's whole bent, and which has been mine most of my adult life, is to eat healthily, and she believes that food can be medicine. It's not that you are what you eat or any of that sort of thing, but she realises and has a great education on all sorts of food, how it helps you live a good and healthy life.
Well, you know, we are what you eat is part of it. It really is.
I saw a
video of myself about 2 years ago where I was sitting out on a deck having a quite white wine, and Joni was taking some video of me, and I put it in the computer and forgot all about it. And about 6 months ago, I came across it, and I thought, holy moly, is that really me? So I've decided to do something about that, and it's not so much what you eat, it's how much of it you eat.
Well, it's all of that. We have a lot of fruit and veggies and all that sort of thing. It's not a vegetarian diet or a vegan diet, or we're very careful about how much energy input as opposed to energy output.
Yep, that's what it's about.
And Samantha is either at the gym or at Pilates, or she swims laps. She's at the moment raising money by swimming a certain amount of laps for youth mental illness.
Very good.
So, and she always puts back. And during the floods in northern New South Wales, she set up a one-person production line and cooked over 100 meals for all the people, the local people here. So, I really think health and how you go about your life has got to do with your attitude.
Oh, sure.
And her attitude is, a lot of people use the word holistic, but I think what it means really is the whole of everything you do, whether it's your food intake and your drink intake but it's also got to do with not just the work that you do to survive, but the work that you do to help others survive.
Sure.
I think that whole attitude of a full life is a wonderful way to stay alive.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree with you more, mate. And sometimes we learn about this perhaps a bit too late in life. It's something that everyone should give a little more consideration to, that's for sure. You have met your soulmate, I can hear that, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. It seems to me that all my friends around me have noticed a change in me as well. I'm less worried about stuff these days, which I think is very helpful. I don't dwell on the negative at all, and I don't surround myself with people who bring negative into my life.
No, I stay very, very clear of people like that, and I learnt that some time ago. In fact, I was... we'll open up to each other here, Norm. It was 1979, so I'm going back some time, and I was in radio. I'd been successful in radio. I was happy in radio. But then I found that the people who were at the pointy part of the administration, if you like, of those running the business that I was in, were just a little bit irritating, and I let that get to me, and I thought, no, I don't need to do this anymore. So I made that decision of what you just mentioned there in 1979. I'm better for it. I feel better for it. And then I thought, no, I don't need to do this anymore, and I just let it go, because you've got to do that, Norm.
You've got to give back to the people who give goodness into your life too, or the good things into your life. And I think I'm sounding like somebody from a Holy Rollers church or something, but it's not that at all. It's just that, I think you have to let your friends know that you are a friend and to be a good friend.
Yes. Yes.
There's certain people I ring every single day, and there are certain people who, I never forget. and whether it's just a little text or whatever, just to make sure that we're all going along okay, I think it's a really important thing. You know,
absolutely.
You don't shut people out.
Yeah, could not agree
especially
with you more.
Especially people that, who help to give you your life.
Now, talking about some people who help to give you your life, going back to the very early days of your career in Northcote, what we're talking about, 63, 64 at that time, you were a kid, fresh-faced, wet behind the ears. you were on stage trying to make a mark. Those early days were probably the best days of your life because we were all so determined to do what it was that we had to do.
Well, the early days of my life, career-wise, I guess, I mean, family has always been an important part of my life, a very, very important part. And they, I think, set me up for being able to cope with an industry that is fraught with disappointment.
Sure.
And so that was one of the most important basics in my life. I had a great mother and father, a great brother and sister. I didn't realize, in fact, that we were almost on the edge of being poor. We weren't. We were wealthy in love and happiness and fun. And, you know, we got the things we got to do. I wanted to learn the guitar. Mum found a way to pay for some guitar lessons. My brother bought a guitar and he tried to play it, couldn't get it together because he was working at the time. Just started an apprenticeship and he had found enough money to buy a guitar and couldn't get it together and just said, would you like it? And then I was away. I had a guitar. Mum found lessons for me at the Victoria Banjo Club and eventually down to the Lou Tapano Music School in at St Kilda Junction many years ago. And I can remember going into town on a tram with my guitar every Thursday night after school. And I was 10, 11. That's a big adventure for a kid that young.
Absolutely.
And then the Lou Tapano Music School had a Christmas concert. I won a competition. Oh, well, it wasn't a competition. I won the best performance of the night trophy at the Lou Tapano Music School for, I think it was 1957, which is 10 years after I was born. The various things that had happened to me, you know, little singing at things at school and singing at stuff with when mum and dad would go out, that set me up for a course for life. And I've never, ever been scared of getting up in front of people, no matter whether it's one person and you're expecting 1,000 or 1,000 people when you weren't ready for one. And I think we did a concert that is not recognized very much with the Go Show in the 1960s at the Sydney Meyer Music Bowl, and there were 100,000 people there.
Yeah.
Nobody ever recognized. They tried to tell us that there were 200,000 people watching the Seekers at one stage, and as good as the Seekers were and successful as they were, and they were always a wonderful adornment, if you like, to the Australian entertainment industry. There is no way that you could put 200,000 people at the Sydney Meyer Music Bowl. I mean, that's too Melbourne cricket grounds.
Well, it is. It's almost like having trying to squeeze 100,000 into that area there. The other 100,000 would be over the hill and down in Domain Road somewhere.
Yeah, you couldn't do it. It's impossible. Anyway, all that aside, I did a Moomba concert with the band that we'd formed at school, and a couple of members of the band also went to the Lou Tapano Music School, and Stan the Man Rofe from 3KZ was the compere, and he was probably the linchpin for the rest of my life, I've got to say, because Stan was a wonderful man. He knew his contemporary music back to front, and he was extremely pro not just Australian music, but certainly Melbourne music. People like Johnny Chester and Bobby Cookson and Colin Cook, Betty McQuaid, all those people who had hits in the early 60s out of Melbourne, usually with W&G, were all probably due to the fact that Stan Rofe promoted them endlessly. And the Thunderbirds, who had a wonderful instrumental called Wild Weekend, were on at Preston Town Hall one night, and they used to variously back all the artists, as did Johnny Chester's band, The Chessmen. Chess wasn't there that night, that Stan took me, and I was 13, to Preston Town Hall. And I sang with these people I'd only ever heard about on the radio. I wasn't old enough to go to these dances yet. And Stan took me, put me on the stage, and nothing, it never really looked back.
That's incredible. That's a great story. And I was a very, very long admirer of Stan Rofe. Stan and I were adversaries at a later stage to the one that you're talking about. But he was a guy that knew what he was doing. He had a sixth sense in recognizing talent. He knew that people were determined, and by God, he was determined to make sure that they did what they loved and wanted to do. So I have great admiration for him. I recall going to his funeral, and it was one of the saddest days in the music business at that time. And I could not believe that there were more than 1,000 people packed into the cathedral. It was just incredible.
Well, I was at that funeral, and my one regret is that I just didn't have it in me to get up and say the things that I felt today, I feel today needed to be said. But I was too sad. I just could not get up and say the things that I wanted to say about Stan, but because you know, he lived that life right to the very end as well. He was DJing at rock and roll dances, and he knew the audiences as much as he knew the music, and I think that's one of the things, one of the downfalls to many radio and television presenters of any sort. They don't get amongst the people, and after a while they do tend to end up with some sort of chasm between themselves and the people that they think are their audiences, you know. I think the best presenters are the ones who really clearly and naturally identify their humanity.
You've hit it in one, mate. You really have. And those are the things that I was getting at a little earlier, where things began to change. There are very few people in media who have that quintessential thing where they have an ability to engage with people. And Stan had that in spades.
And, you know, it was like dying and going to heaven. I was surrounded by people who had already runs of experience on the board. And so it was an incredible learning period for me too. You know, I mean, when I went to rehearsal with the Chessmen, and they're talking of, and Chester was there. Chester was my big idol, you know. And even now I find it difficult and almost nerve-wracking to speak with people like Chess and Cole Joy, who is another one of my great heroes, my great life heroes, you know. I just always found it really difficult. And it's funny, I never had that same connection with Johnny O'Keefe. I got on really well with Jock, but he wasn't the person the sort of person that I wanted to style myself after, yet Johnny Chester was and Cole Joy was.
Well, you see, you've mentioned two names there, Cole Joy, Johnny Chester. They had a wonderful way to engage with an audience, whereas
yes.
JOK was very much his own person, and we all know that. He was very much his own person. It was all about him, and we saw him perhaps cut through, maybe in a more quicker, perhaps more brash way to get noticed than anyone else was doing at that time. And that made him quite different. I mean, I loved him. He was a wonderful guy. He was a guy that also knew how to, shall I say, stroke the media. And therefore, he had that thing going that we all just loved and admired. But he was very closed when you tried to get to know him.
I spent a lot of time with Johnny O'Keefe over the years. John was 24/7 switched on to his career.
Yes.
And I knew Barry, his brother, Barry O'Keefe. I mean, it was a very professional family. His dad was the mayor of Mosman in Sydney, and Barry was a QC. And, of course, John, in his own right, was an incredibly professionally oriented person. I couldn't live my life like Jock. There was bits and pieces of myself I had to keep for myself, and they were things like, you know, the love of my mum and dad, my brother and sister, all my family, and that's always tantamount. And when you look at Cole and the Jacobson family, and they've spent most of their lives in each other's pockets outside of show business. But I don't know that Jock had that much a family social time during the day to do that. I really think family is the glue that holds everything together.
Yeah, I was about to say exactly the same thing, Norm. That's it. You've hit it in one. Obviously, that's the thing that we all need to consider, perhaps even more than we really think.
Well, I got a call from my daughter yesterday who was a trained actor and has been working outside of the industry since she's a mum of two kids. Putting them through school and all that sort of stuff and attending to all the family thing. She just landed the role of narrating Peter and the Wolf for the Stonington Symphony Orchestra.
Wow.
And the last person to do that with them was Derek Gill. So a lot of people might remember Derek on the ABC.
Yes.
A wonderful doyen of he loved his country music, especially live music, especially folk music and country music, and he was always seen at festivals and everything. A lovely, affable bloke. So it was great to see my daughter. I got as much thrill out of hearing that as I'd have anything that I've ever done. Being able to say, "Hey, look what I've just landed."
Yeah, exactly. And it's a lovely feeling that you get that feeling of pride with your family when that happens. It's a lovely connection. It really is.
True.
Speaking of people that come into your lives, there is one person that I believe needs to really have more recognition. He's certainly enjoyed quite a large amount of recognition along the journey, but we need to also just reassure him that we love him and we thank him for a number of the things that he did. I worked with him in radio. He's a good friend of yours, Norm, and a good mate of mine. I speak to him on the phone, and we have some of the longest telephone conversations in the world. His name is Bruce Stewart. Tell me about Bruce.
Bruce used to work for 3DB in the 60s and decided to run these concerts at Festival Hall on Sunday afternoons. Mm. And he must have wandered around all the dances on a Saturday night, of which there were a plethora, and he would look at all the artists, and next thing you know, they'd be on stage on a Sunday afternoon. Now, the thing about that was that Preston Town Hall had their artists, Hawthorne Town Hall or somewhere like that. They had their artists. There was the Highway Club at Moorabbin, and the Mentone Town Hall had their artists. There was a place out at Glenroy, dancers there, and there were dancers in Dandenong, all over the place. But we never got to see each other. And we'd hear about it because all these dancers would advertise on Stan Rofe's programs, but we never got to see these other artists. And all of a sudden, we're on the stage with these people from all over. I think it was almost like a magnet that drew everybody from every wherever music was happening in Melbourne, dragged them all into the one place so that we had that cross-fertilisation thing happening.
Yep, yep.
There were people like the Phantoms and the Saxons and Johnny Cooper and just a million different artists who appeared there that were well known on the radio thing, but were only seen at their local dances.
Yeah, it was like a revolving door. People would come in the back door, they'd sing two songs, go, and you'd have someone else on stage.
That's right, and it was a dance. The whole ground level was an open. All the seats would roll back, yep. And it was just a big dance. So whereas you'd normally have, I think it was maybe 7,000 people. At a big festival hall concert, you'd have about that every Sunday afternoon, but they're all standing up dancing and enjoying what was the local artists of the day. Every now and then there'd be an artist come in from Sydney. Just bear in mind that you didn't have the communication technology that we have today. I can remember, for instance, the very first coaxial cable presentation where Don Lane was in Sydney and Graham Kennedy was in Melbourne, and they had a split screen and they were talking to each other, and we just thought that was science fiction.
Had come to town. I remember that very clearly. I was at Channel 9 when that was going on, and I remember the cable sometimes would fail and someone would run out with a truck and solder some stuff together, and a bang, it was back again. It was fabulous.
But we can put a pair of earphones in our ears these days and listen in stereo. But I remember the very first stereo presentation I ever heard was when 3UZ and 3XY teamed together, and they told us how to set up our radios in our house. So kitchen, we had two mantle radios set up. One on 3UZ and one on 3XY, pretty sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had a steam train running through our kitchen and an aeroplane going from one radio station to the other. It was like, wow, that's amazing. You can do that.
Yeah.
And then a few years later, here I am in a recording studio in Sydney recording the very first album ever recorded for stereo in Australia. But now you can do it in your bathroom. You can do it in your lounge. You can do it on your iPhone or your iPad things and all that sort of thing with GarageBand or you multi-tracking. We saw these dirty big machines come in with 2-inch tape running across, and they could record up to 24 tracks.
Yes.
Now you can have unlimited tracks on your home computer.
Well, that's what I've got right here at the moment. I've got 64 tracks of multi-track if I want to use them. But I have never had the reason to do that.
I would say that's a little bit of overkill, but nevertheless.
Totally, absolutely. So memories of Bruce in the 60s. One other person that was in your life, this came a little bit later. Tell me about your friend Ivan Damon.
Well, Ivan came to Melbourne from Adelaide where he ran a couple of dances. He bought two picture theatres that weren't, they were failing and they went up for sale. One was at Canterbury and the other one was at Preston, the Preston Circle, and the Canterbury Picture Theatre. And they became the Preston Circle Ballroom and the Canterbury Ballroom. And he started off running 60-40 dances. That was 60% old time and 40% rock and roll. So they were still had a little bit of a square element. The other dances around Melbourne were basically straight-out rock and roll dances. So Ivan had these two dances going, and eventually, after working some period of time at Preston Town Hall, he bought from the operator, Kevin McClellan, bought Preston Town Hall, and he was running Preston Town Hall Circle, and I was working at Preston Town Hall. Eventually, I started working at the rock and roll nights at Preston Circle Ballroom, which gave me 3 nights a week work. And then eventually he had another one out at Sunshine called the Sunshine Mariana Hall. And he put me in there as well. So I was working fairly regularly, doing, you know, 4 and 5 nights a week at various dances, until, of course, the Go Show arrived on the scene. And I became a regular on that. And that was when I guess we all rode this wave that was pretty much catalyzed by the arrival of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the, you know, the Mersey Sound and all that sort of stuff out of England. And we were able to, emulate that sort of stuff very well in Australia. And then people were writing their own songs. And I think the actual songwriting thing was biggest through the 70s, but it had to start somewhere where we were confident enough that we could do music as well as people from anywhere else in the world. And I still believe that today.
Yeah, I do too. It was Ivan Damon then went on and created or came up with the record label Sunshine, which was released through Festival Records.
Yeah, Sunshine Records started at the Cloudland Ballroom in Brisbane, which was another one, and it was the headquarters for Ivan's whole national operation. Cloudland Ballroom was the biggest ballroom in the Southern Hemisphere. It was General Douglas MacArthur's headquarters during the Second World War. So it can give you an idea how big it was.
Sure.
One of the singers there was Pat Alton out of Adelaide. Now, Patrick he wanted to produce records. And so he said to Ivan, look, you've got all these wonderful artists all working for you all over Australia. Why don't we start a record label and record all these artists and give them some, you know, something to promote? And I think probably the first artist he ever recorded, I'm pretty sure, was Tony Worsley and the Blue Jays. I must clear that with Tony. I'm pretty sure it was. Tony's still a great mate of mine. I saw him yesterday, actually. And so the Blue Jays came out of Melbourne and he paired Tony out of Brisbane with the Blue Jays, and then they started touring all around Australia doing different shows. I'm pretty sure Marcy Jones was the next artist they recorded, and the Blue Jays did the backing for that. And then, of course, the Playboys, this is around 1964, the Playboys recorded Exodus, and soon after that I recorded with them. We rehearsed It Ain't Necessarily So after the dance on a Sunday night at Preston Circle, and we went into the studio early in the following week on the Monday, Tuesday, which is now the Mimo Music Hall at the back of the St Kilda RSL. And we recorded It Ain't Necessarily So. The engineer was Bill Armstrong. And it was beautifully produced by Pat Alton, who went on to be a very famous jingle writer. He wrote things like Weet-Bix Kids, and a couple of Coca-Cola commercials were going on a magic carpet ride, and Fancy Nancy Fancy's Orange Fanta. Amazing, successful jingle writing career he had.
You know, you've really made my brain spin around a little bit there with a couple of mentions of Coca-Cola commercials and the commercials that we played on radio. Boy, were they creative. Pat Alton, who I met along the way, naturally, he was a wonderful producer. You mentioned the Playboys. When did the Playboys materialize? Who was in the original lineup with you?
Well, the Playboys materialized out of Trotter the Drummer came out of the Chessmen.
Yes.
He was in the Roulettes before that. The two guitarists, John and Billy, and the bass player came out of a band called The Imposters, which was a big rock and roll band. They had piano, two guitars, bass, drums, and two saxophones.
Wow.
So it was a pretty thunderous sound they had on stage.
Yeah. When did Phil Blackmore join you?
When the Playboys started, Phil was the original keyboard player.
I see, yeah.
And Phil, we were the two youngest in the whole Normie Rowe and the Playboys entities. You know, the rest of the guys were almost our big brothers by probably 2, 3, 4 years. I think the first bass player was Ronnie Brain, and then he didn't want to travel around, so I think Neil MacArthur joined us, and then we had Peter Carroll. I said to Trotter one day, what instrument do you like as a drummer to play with? And we only ever had one drummer in the Playboys, Trotter, and he still works with me today. And he's 82. He's a maniac. But
we love him. We love him. We really love him.
Yeah, I think he's the model that Animal was taken from in the Muppets.
Yes.
Anyway, Trotter was the drummer. I think Phil played with Malcolm Arthur and the Knights at one stage, and Phil's brother was Ron Blackmore, who managed a lot of artists, including Bobby and Laurie.
That's right. Yes, that's right.
So, you know, it pretty much started there. But I said to Trotter, what's the instrument you like to play with, you lock into when we're working on stage? He said, oh, definitely the bass player. And I said, do you know how many bass players we ever had? And he said, no. And I said, we had 9.
Holy.
What does that say about you, Trotter?
Holy moly.
He was wearing them out like an old pair of runners.
Yes, he would have been, absolutely. Phil Blackmore, just to finish on that, became one of my audio operators when I was at Channel 10, and he was a gun there, he really was, and sadly passed far too young.
Oh, way too young. He had a car accident many years earlier, and they had to put a plate in his skull. It was early days for that sort of surgery, and I don't think it ever did him any favours, to be quite honest. He was pretty much the musicality genius of the band, because he's the only one who had any classical training.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because when you listen to a lot of your early stuff, you know, you can hear the keys in the background, well, not so much in the background, even in the foreground, often.
When you consider the instrumentals they did Exodus, they did Sabre Dance, they did a thing called The Breeze and I. They had instrumentals and they were very successful. In fact, they had the best album, I think, of 1964, voted by all the radio stations around Australia.
How about that?
The best instrumental band, yeah. Because instrumental bands were a big thing, you know. Well, the Joy Boys had some instrumentals out. And of course, you had the Atlantics with Bombora and the Thunderbirds with Wild Weekend. You know, the Cherokees, they had stuff, and eventually they became a vocal group, but they were largely a band that played stuff like with the lineup of the Shadows out of England were having major hits with their instrumentals too.
I can recall an instrumental track. It was from America. And I just forget the name of the group that put it together, but the name of the song was No Matter What Shape Your Stomach's In. Do you remember that?
No.
Oh, hang on a flash, Norm. I've got it here. This is it. Don't you feel a whole lot better?
Well, of course, out of America with Adventures, you know, with Walk, Don't Run, and the Atlantic's Bombora, funnily enough, was quite a big hit in America.
It was.
When we did Long Way to the Top, they were front and centre with just one song. They were fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. And that's where we leave part one of our fireside chat with Normie Rowe on this episode of the Last Post Radio Show podcast. Be sure to join us for our next podcast just a few days before Anzac Day 2024, when we'll continue my chat with Norman John Rowe. Uppermost, Normie will go into detail about his call-up and tour of duty in the Vietnam War during the late 60s. We'll discuss his passionate support for all veterans who have participated in the theatre of war, both past and present. The support of veterans' families and the sacred importance of Anzac Day. Norm has always attended the Dawn service. In our next podcast, he'll discuss the plans for his involvement this year at the Dawn service on Currumbin Beach in Queensland, that will be televised on the Sunrise program on the 7 Network. I'm Gary Mack. On behalf of Greg T. Ross, thank you for listening.